May 4th, 2001. Jillian Sullivan, 47, recently released from the federal prison camp for women at Alderson, West Virginia, sat with a cigarette in a small Center City coffee shop, awaiting Arthur Raven. On the phone, Raven, whom she had known for well more than a decade, had made a point to say he wished to see her for business. Like so many others, he apparently did not want her to think he would be offering consolation or support. She was reconsidering her decision to come, not for the first time, when she saw Arthur charging through the glass doors of the restaurant vestibule with a briefcase bundled under his arm. "Judge," he said, and offered his hand. It struck a false note instantly. Even before her disgrace, it had been unlikely he'd call her judge in private. "Jillian will do, Arthur." "I'm sorry." "It's awkward." She crushed out the cigarette, thinking only now that the smoke might bother him. In her time, Jillian had gone from prosecutor to judge and then to convicted criminal defendant. It was an extreme example, but even her wayward career reflected the nature of the criminal bar, which was much like a repertory theater company, in which every attorney was apt to have a turn at each part. The prosecutor against whom you tried a case was on the bench the next time you saw her, and in private practice hustling your clients a decade after that. Rivalries and friendships were fortified or forgotten in the parade of years, while every achievement or failure endured somewhere in the memory of the community. Understanding all that, Jillian nonetheless found the fortunes that had brought her together again with sad, driven little Arthur Raven somehow indigestible. 13 years ago, after 20 months on the bench, Jillian had received her first assignment in the criminal courts, presiding over misdemeanor cases and probable cause hearings. Arthur Raven was the deputy prosecuting attorney delegated to her courtroom. They were each new to their jobs, and at that point she was certain her prospects were far brighter than Arthur's. It was common in trial practice to find men and women skilled in making themselves appealing, people who had mastered the outward gestures of candor and humility, even when they masked a volcanic core of egocentricity and ambition. With Arthur, what you saw was what you got, relentless intensity and a desire to win that bordered on the desperate. As if it was not a ridiculously loaded question, Arthur now asked, "And how have you been?" "So-so," she answered. The truth was that after several years of coming to grips, she was realizing she had not come to grips at all. "You still look terrific," he offered. In Jillian's experience, a man's motives for complimenting a woman were always suspect, a stepping stone to sex or some less grandiose manipulation. She asked abruptly what this was about. "Well," he said, "let me use your word. It's awkward. I've been appointed by the U.S. Court of Appeals on a case, a second habeas Romney Gandolf. Do you recall the name?" She did, naturally. Searching her memory of the Gandolf trial, she could still summon the photos of the bodies in the restaurant food locker. "Right," said Raven when she described the case. "Good, Gus. But you know the game. I have to plow every row. There are even moments when I'm delusional and think he might be innocent. I have this associate," he said. "She's been tearing this case apart, coming up with amazing stuff. Here, look at this." From out of his thick case, Raven handed over the first of several sheets of paper. Apparently, he was trying to work up a theory that Gandolf had been in jail on a probation violation at the time of the murders. Few records remained, and Gandalf's rap sheet offered no corroboration. But within the last few days, Arthur had found a transfer manifest showing that his client had been transported to court on the morning of July 5, 1991, from the House of Corrections. "And what does Muriel say to that?" Jillian asked. Muriel Wynne, who'd been the junior prosecutor on the case a decade ago, was now the chief deputy PA and the short-odds favorite to succeed Ned Halsey as the prosecuting attorney in next year's election. Jillian had never cared much for Muriel, the kind of hard-boiled woman the felony courthouse produced often these days.
"She thinks Rami's probation officer must have gone out and collared him that morning so he didn't blow his court date," Arthur said. "I don't buy it on a Friday right after a holiday when nobody wanted to be working." Muriel also says it's ridiculous to think that both the client and the defense lawyer missed the fact that Rami was in jail when the murders went down. But he wasn't arrested until 4 months after the crime, and Rami doesn't know today from tomorrow.
Gillian's wager would have been that Muriel was correct, but she was unwilling to jump into the argument. With Arthur, she felt recalled to a mode of decorum she thought she'd left behind. She was trying to be judicial. "And what is it that you want to know from me, Arthur, if I have second thoughts?" At this point, no one would care about her opinion. And she had no doubts anyway about Gandalf's guilt. She'd settled that again in her own mind months ago when the prisoner's letter had arrived from Rudyard.
"The Court of Appeals is killing me with kindness," he said. "Probably because they appointed me. I begged for a chance to do discovery, and they sent the matter down to the district court until June 29th, before they decide whether to permit Gandalf to actually file a new habeas. So I'm turning over every stone."
He finally ended his studied efforts not to look at her.
"Listen, I have to ask. While you sat in felony, were you doing what got you into trouble later, when you were hearing personal injury cases?"
She had not been enjoying this conversation much as it was, but now that she recognized the direction, a familiar freeze overcame her. "No, Arthur, I wasn't taking money when I heard criminal matters. No one bribed me on Rami Gandalf's case or any other case at that time. It began in common pleas where it seemed to be the order of the day." She shook her head once, both at the lunacy of it and because her remark sounded faintly like an excuse. "All right," he said, but he was plainly applying a lawyer's judgment to her answer, weighing its verity. Watching him calculate, she decided that Arthur did not look particularly well. He was short and had never appeared especially fit, but he was aging before his time. She recalled then that he had a situation, family trouble, someone chronically sick. Perhaps it had worn him out.